Hey guys, it's Brittany. Just a quick note before you listen to this week's episode. Eric and I actually recorded it at the beginning of February. So when you listen to it, we are going to make a lot of references to things that were relevant at the beginning of February. We just didn't release it in the past month because we had some other work that was just a little bit more time sensitive. So please do not be confused at all when we reference the Super Bowl as something that is forthcoming or talk about Formation like it just came out, because to us in this episode, it just did. So we had a lot of fun making this episode and we hope that you guys enjoy it. And let's get started.
Hi, I'm Eric.
And I'm Brittany.
And we are
the Color Nerds.
The conversations that black people have
when white people aren't in the room.
But we record them.
And we put them on the internet. Welcome. Share them with everybody.
Yes. Put it out there.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Right now, we are in the thick of Black History Month.
Yes. It feels good. Still feels good. Still feels good.
Somebody caught the Black History Month spirit. I tell you what.
Who you talking about?
Beyonce, Giselle Knowles Carter.
Yeah.
She released the blackest music video
of 2016
yeah. This far.
That's fair.
I'm excited because at first when the Beyonce Coldplay video came out, which was an embarrassment. God, that was an embarrassment.
God, good people, man. I have good people around.
Just because the Stacey Dash, a video directors in India, tells you that what you're doing makes sense.
Doesn't mean
it makes sense.
Yeah.
And you gotta, y'all, everybody gotta know better. What was interesting though is that a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, mm-hmm. Iman, who we've talked about before on the show, she actually, because I saw the Coldplay video and I watched like 30 seconds of it. And I was like, first of all, the song was trash. And then I watched the video and I was like, this is embarrassing.
Yeah.
I'm like depressed. But then she showed me like 5 more music videos that had come out recently that were like, that bad or even worse.
Yeah, it's messed.
Where I was just like, wait, how did I not like even, and like some of them were for really popular songs where I was just like, what?
Yeah. I mean, I generally hate the destination. I'm this person. This video is interesting because I'm in a new like environment and look at all these like really cool people around me.
Yeah.
Like, isn't that neat? Aren't they awesome?
Yeah, don't they dress so cool?
Yeah, I'm just gonna dress like them and that makes it great. Like, yeah. I mean, that shit is real weak. Like, Katy Perry does that a lot. Obviously, Katy Perry
does it all the time.
Yeah. But yeah, like, so, you know, to see, like, it made sense. Because it was a Coldplay video. Real talk, Beyonce sometimes does do that shit herself. Like, in some of her other videos, not as much with the cultural tourism, but in terms of like putting herself in something that already exists, and like the two are very, very similar. Like with her performances, like
be specific.
So like the Countdown video, like the fact that it's like a shot for shot remake of this other like
film. Oh, she does that. Or even like the what is it? She did the whole Rich Man's Frug from like Sweet Charity, like that one video. Was it Get Me Body? Was like, oh. But I mean, she usually does those things and says exactly where they come from.
Yeah, again, I'm not saying it's like as bad as the Coldplay video, but I'm just saying it wasn't as surprising. Like, a lot of people weren't necessarily surprised that that happened the way it happened, and she said yes.
I mean, I don't put that shit past anybody.
Yeah,
it's 2016.
I mean, a certain level of money, you know, you probably say yes to a lot of things that you probably shouldn't say yes to. doing a song with Coldplay.
Doing a song with Coldplay in 2016 is one of those things where I'm like, who told you they were hot?
Yeah. So what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to talk about Ida B. Wells.
Ida B. Wells.
It's Black History Month. And
tell us how we got here.
So I take Black History Month really seriously. This year I was like, I really want to read a really serious historical profile on somebody. And so I remember Melissa Harris Perry in a talk. I think it was the one that she did with Michaela Angela Davis. I think somebody, or Michaela Angela, asked her who her favorite historical figure was, or her favorite historical black one was. And she said something about Ida B. Wells and how she just felt like Ida B. Wells was just like such a real person. Like, she was not just an incredible human being, but also she was also just very human and like was a real person and dealt with regular person struggles and regular person bullshit. I want to say both she and I think also Ta-Nehisi Coates suggested Paula Giddings' A Sword Among Lions, like the biography about Ida B. Wells. So, having recently discovered the Kindle app.
Yes.
So, I started reading it, and I'm not going to lie to you. I have I haven't finished it because, you know, when you open the book in the Kindle, they're like, okay, like, you know, you turn the page and they're like, you have 3 hours and 44 minutes left in this book. You know, if you just sat there and read it straight through. This one, I like, I had to like rub my eyes and blink a lot because they were like, you have 23 hours left. I was like, it's the book is
settle in. But I, honestly, I love those type. I love those types of biographies, like Manning Marable biography of Malcolm X is like that. And it is fucking excellent.
You learn so much
extra shit instead of getting like the kind of that condensed version you usually get.
Yeah. So I started reading this book and I got like through the prologue and I was like, I think I started, this is such a, whatever, I'm telling bougie black woman story, I don't care. I was able to read it when I was getting my nails done because I was getting shellac.
Yeah.
And so like I would have my one free hand like turning the pages and
like shellac, like.
That's how my nails are still on.
Like.
Shellac, you go.
I know shellac, like you shellac a like
no,
floor.
Shellac is a type of manicure where you can, this is probably, this is, I'm sure that the UV light lamp that they put on your nails in between coatings has to be carcinogenic, but you know, YOLO.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, I started crying while I was sitting in the nail shop. I couldn't believe that this person had lived, like I was only like learning about a very tiny portion of her life, like one aspect of a very tiny portion of her life.
Not even deep in.
No. And I was stunned by how incredible of a human being she was. And that she's a black woman who existed maybe like 120 years ago. And I knew very little about her life.
Yeah.
Like I never learned about her in elementary, middle, high school.
Yeah.
I knew that she was an anti-lynching person. I didn't know that she was a suffragist. I didn't really have any understanding of, even we talked last week a little bit about public intellectual.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
I had no clue.
She definitely kind of was that.
Yeah.
Like, not even kind of. She was that.
She was that. And she was an investigative journalist. And she was, I just didn't, she did so many different things in her lifetime. And in the 1800s and early 1900s. And she was this black woman. And I don't feel like there's ever been a rush to make sure that I or anybody my age really knew a lot about her.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would definitely agree. I think, I mean, so, and honestly, this is why I'm glad we're having this conversation. I mean, just to be honest, I told you I didn't know that much about her. I'm from Memphis. We'll get like deeper into her ties to Memphis probably later in the in the episode. But reading this, I'm like, how the fuck have I never had a conversation about her?
Yeah.
Her contribution to the city. In addition to that, like I think I also just think in terms of Black History Month in general, like sometimes a lot of the criticisms for Black History Month is like all these great people are sometimes reduced to kind of like footnotes. You know?
Yeah.
I mean that happens with some people more than others, usually, you know, people of a certain gender.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But she's definitely one of those people who it's like her name is in the list.
Yeah.
But it doesn't go much like further beyond that. There's like a sentence or two description of her and then it's like, you know, we kind of move on. But we should talk more about like her life. We should go ahead and just kind of jump into it.
Okay. So like Ida B. Wells is an incredible person.
Yeah.
But like there's a couple things going on. So first of all, she was born technically into slavery.
Yeah.
And
in like 1862.
And then 2 years later, she was like she's freed in her early childhood.
Yeah.
And like neither one of us like starting to read about this stuff has illuminated how wild the Reconstruction period is.
And I think before we even get into her, you got to kind of talk about her parents really, really quick.
Yeah.
So the fascinating thing about Ida B. Wells was kind of like her commitment to education at that point throughout her early life really kind of set her up for like her later activism and approach. That wouldn't have been able to happen if it weren't for like the profile I read kind of described it as lucky. Like there were a few different things that would allow you to, as a black person, have access to kind of like a better life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was either if you were really favored by your master, which is so fucking weird to use the word master in conversation.
Yeah.
But if you were favored by your master, if you were apprenticed for some sort of like
skill or trade,
or if you were on loan like to many different plantations.
Yeah.
And like her father, James Wells, I think it is, was basically all three of those things. He, you know, had a really good relationship with his master for the most part. Again, because his master was his father.
Yeah.
He was apprenticed at a young age in terms of being like a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, like after he like got those skills, he was put out on loan to other plantations and places. So he had a ridiculous amount of freedom.
Well, even in the Giddings book, even in Sword Among Lions, they talk about how Holly Springs was a very peculiar place even to like be a slave. You think about slavery in Mississippi.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
It's like, I mean, if, even if you've seen, like, and this is fucking horrible.
What, analogy?
Yeah, but no, Django, like.
Oh, I haven't seen. I mean. Yeah, I had no desire.
It's fine.
I'm fine.
but in terms of, like, getting an understanding, some sort of context for how, like, Mississippi was the worst. Mississippi was,
right.
like, some of the worst place
but
you could
be. But weirdly enough, Holly Springs was not as wild as it could have been.
Yeah.
Or it was, or as it was in other places nearby. Her father occupied all three of those, like, those things that you talked about.
Yeah.
But, like, that Holly Springs seems like it was a place where that was kind of
was
possible.
I agree. For at least that's why I took from being here. And so, like, right after the end of slavery, you know, he was in this kind of prime position to have, I wouldn't say a significant amount of power, but to be pretty well respected to the point where there was a high commitment to education. You know, there mm-hmm. was something to point out, like Ida B. Wells would read the newspaper to her father. That's significant if you think about probably like not like 10 years before that, learning how to read and being black was illegal.
Yes.
So her having access to these parents, her mom being educated a little bit at Rust College as well, mm-hmm. like her having access to these parents who had a focus and had a capability of being able to kind of push them quickly into the resources that they would need to be successful later
yeah.
in life was really, really, I think, significant.
Yeah.
Especially as you get into what happened next.
It's like, it was like weird. It was like this weird period of time where like slavery had technically ended, but like Jim Crow was not yet
entrenched.
Like, yeah, entrenched.
And even being like, being super valuable too. Like,
yeah.
I mean, to the voting bloc, like there was a passage where they were talking about how both like Southern Democrats and Republicans and, you know, like, if you think about the party affiliations kind of flipped, right,
yeah,
as it was
yeah.
right now. But we're both vying for the black vote because now you have this massive influx of
citizens,
who, you know, had the ability to vote. And that could seriously put a dent or, like, really change and flip the makeup, if you will, of the legislature.
I mean, it's never really a good time.
Yeah.
You know, like I'd say 2016, what a time to be alive.
Yeah.
It's never been better than it is now. But, and it was still terrible in many senses, but like, I can't imagine a time in the history of black people in the United States where we went from having so little to relatively so much in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
And so she was getting educated when yellow fever struck the, like, Holly Springs, killed a lot of people, specifically at least one of her siblings
yeah.
and both her parents.
Yeah.
And so the government in Holly Springs was like, all right, we're going to split your family up. And she was kind of like,
nah.
I think she was like 16 or something. And she
yeah.
was like, mm-mm, we're not going to do that. She was like, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to keep everybody together. Like, she had one sister who was developmentally challenged, and
yeah.
they were going to put her in like a pauper's home, basically,
yeah.
like an institution for abandoned children.
And just imagine even being told that.
Yeah.
So like, oh, your sister, your sibling,
yeah,
who you've
we're
grown up with, we're just... Yeah, she's just going to go to this place.
Right, and then the rest of her siblings were going to be split up between, like, other people's houses. And she was just like, nah. So she's already born into slavery, became freed in her, like, younger childhood.
Yeah.
Like, in this weird Reconstruction period where she's getting a lot of education and she has kind of a decent amount of opportunity allowed to her. And then this thing wipes her family out and they're like, oh, we're going to split everybody up. And she's like, no, we're not.
And, I mean, and that in itself is pretty revolutionary at the time. So, like there weren't single parents how we know
no.
there to be single parents right now.
No.
And I mean, mind you, she's not a parent. She's just taking care of her siblings.
Yeah.
So, you know, she got a job, was living in their house like by herself. And apparently, you know, people were like, what is she doing?
People
like,
were mean about it.
Yeah. They were like, why doesn't she have a man? Basically, like, why she doesn't have some man that's trying to take care of? Like,
that's
what's wrong
familiar.
With her? But in addition to, you know, people will also be like, oh, well, she must have some secret white man.
Yep, giving her money and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, and like, that's some wild shit.
That's some wild shit. This is all before she's like 20.
Yeah. She moved from Holly Springs to Memphis with her siblings. She brought them there because at the time she could make more money teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And while she was in Memphis, she started like, that's when she started actually like writing. And I found she was apparently writing in like a pen name or something like that.
Mm.
But basically everybody found out that she was saying real shit in the paper. and they
Call
were like,
folks to the carpet.
Yeah, I see, you can't teach no more. Yeah. Because you ain't got no chill. And she was like, okay, you know, I'm just going to be basically a full-time journalist. And she kind of committed herself to being a journalist on issues of race.
Yes.
Which, again, at the time, you know, being a black woman who mm-hmm. is a writer.
Yes.
Who's writing about issues of race.
It's hard to do that. In now. 2016, yeah. with a degree, with like a master's from like Columbia J School.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I'd be also doing this in the late 1800s.
Yeah. And, you know, eventually, like, I think she founded her own paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, she founded her own paper. But as she started writing and kind of blowing up, this is all happening in Memphis. Again, we never really, and maybe this was just my school, maybe this was just my, you know,
yeah.
my shitty education.
I mean, I knew they weren't going to teach us about no... No anti-lynching black women in Farmington public schools.
Yeah, but it's like fascinating. Apparently in the like main paper, now it's called the Commercial Appeal, but I think it was called the Memphis Appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Like there would be like editorials written about her, like where they were like basically coming at her character,
uh-huh.
Like talking about her, like riling up all this shit. And where shit really went down was basically three of her friends who ran a grocery store.
Yep. It was like across the street. It was like in, I think like in like the, what do they call it? The Curve.
Yeah.
Which is a very, it's almost
it's
like
a very black neighborhood
very,
name.
Yeah, it's like. Very black neighborhood name. So they were in the Curve. I think they're across the street from a white grocer.
Yeah.
And they were doing good business.
And that's a problem because if I'm a white grocer, I don't want no black person getting money.
Sounds
all the money
familiar.
Is mine.
Hmm. Sounds familiar.
Yeah. Parallels. But so yeah, so they basically
they tried to
fight them. Black folks were like, we ain't going.
Yeah,
you know?
We ain't going down like that. I think they like shot back
because
yeah. they were shooting them or something like that. They were ended up in jail and then they were dragged out in the middle of the night yeah. and lynched.
And lynched. And obviously it's like a extremely like traumatized situation to have three of your like of your friends
mm-hmm.
not only treated in this manner, but killed.
Yeah.
And this really like pushed her to I mean, I guess the best word is like radicalism, but like the best kind, you know,
yeah.
like she really, really, really became like this loudspeaker for
yeah.
like why lynching was so terrible and really was just basically loud. This like loud black woman who was saying all this stuff about lynching and how basically Memphis was not safe.
Yes. Well, this is the thing, though, before we even get to the next point, I also want to point out as a public intellectual, she did something totally impressive, which after her friends were lynched, she first came out and she was like many other persons who had read of lynching in the South, I had accepted the idea meant to be conveyed that although lynching was irregular and contrary to law and order, unreasoning anger over the terrible crime of rape led to the lynching, that perhaps the brute deserved justice and the mob was justified in taking this life. So she's saying like, you know, maybe it was reasonable. Maybe it was justified because maybe this many people were running out here raping. But then when she saw them kill her friends, obviously there were escalating incidents
yeah.
that led to the lynching. But like, she's like, oh, y'all are just doing this shit just because we out here getting money.
Yeah.
You see that if kind of given at least some of the freedoms available to white people,
yeah.
even in the years immediately following slavery, like we have the capacity to amass wealth, own land, and to like form our own communities and not necessarily patronize your businesses. Basically, we're out here getting money and you feel like we're taking out of your pocket because you're in the black neighborhood and we don't want to necessarily buy from you. And so she was like, based upon this new information, I'm about to get real as fuck.
No, there was actually another patch. This was in the in one of the speeches that you linked in the, mm-hmm. in the readings. She said the alleged menace of universal suffrage having been avoided by the absolute suppression of the Negro vote. So basically what she's saying is like you said it was going to be a big ass problem that all these black folks can now vote.
Mm-hmm.
You shut that shit down. You know what I'm saying? Y'all not really actually allowing us to vote.
Yeah.
You would think that this would have satisfied the urge for the butchery of Negroes.
Okay.
She was like, but men, women, and children are the victims of murder by mobs, and just as they have been killed at the demands of this unwritten law. And all this was to prevent Negro domination. So basically, mm-hmm. she was saying, like, you're only doing this shit to keep us down.
Yeah.
You're really only actually doing this shit to keep us down. It's not about, like you were saying, it's not about rape.
Yeah.
And through these speeches, she was like, yo, you need to move the fuck out of Memphis. Memphis is not safe for black people. It's kind of like Kanye. George yeah. Bush doesn't care about yeah. black folks. She basically said Memphis doesn't care about black folks. And 6,000 black people moved from Memphis as a result of that. You know, and that is, you want to talk about power.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Now, mind you, some of them probably also, you know, heard about black folks getting lynched.
Yeah, and they were like, eh, I gotta go.
But the fact that, you know, this woman was the one to, like, really elevate this, because it's not like black folks weren't getting lynched before that. But to make, you know, to bring urgency to that was really, 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 like, fascinating at this particular time. Like, that just wasn't happening like that. So, yeah, so, like, they moved, and then she realized, like, wow, I can really make something happen here. And even going back to what you said, it was clear she was trying to actually understand what were the, like, list of reasons why we were actually being lynched.
Yeah.
That, it seems like, when she committed herself to study, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is where she really, like, picked up the title of, like, investigative journalism, which I think is really interesting. She published a pamphlet cataloging all this research that she had done into the actual data about lynchings. And, like, people, you know, a lot of different people supported this work and supported her in actually doing this work, because it had just never really been done before.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me thinking.
Got you thinking.
You know, if you think about, so, like, this is lynchings at the time. This is basically the
extermination.
Extermination of black people, removal of justice in terms for our death.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that, you know, has been...
They're echoes. They're historical echoes.
Yeah. Of that going on, you know, right now. And her, like, her clear mission and call in terms of studying these particular things were to, like, to actually just shine a light on the data.
Yeah.
Like, to say, hey, you know, like, everybody has these tropes of what we've been attributing this to, but let's actually look at the data. Maybe that will shine some light on what's really actually going down.
Yeah.
And there are clear parallels with that going on right now in terms of police violence. Like, we just haven't really been studying police violence in this country. There was no data. So you could easily say, you know, being a police officer is a dangerous job. And, you know, these shootings, I'm sure police officers would not be shooting
somebody unless they were committing some sort of heinous crime.
Yeah.
It's like, not the truth.
Yeah, or even understanding how often officers were actually being punished as a result of these officer-involved shootings. Like, there was no data, and now that we're actually trying to compile this data, some trends are popping up.
Some trends are
popping
up.
That, you know, we might want to pay attention to. And even if you look at things like body cameras and stuff like that, you know, which is why it's arguable as to their utility in terms of actual prosecutions.
Yeah.
That's still a step that wasn't really, like, that wasn't really pushed for until after we really start shining a light on these situations and the data kind of behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, the parallels with her are really, really interesting.
So another thing that really stuck out to me, and, you know, we talked about, like, how we talked about her anti-lynching work. She became powerful enough at a young age to get people to leave Memphis because it wasn't safe for them to live there.
6,000.
6,000 black people, which is a gigantic number. Yeah. And then, like, you know, she continued to write and travel the country and even go overseas and talk about the importance of anti-lynching work. But something I didn't know about her until I started really learning more and reading more about her was that she was also a suffragist.
Yeah.
I had no idea how important her work was to... Just really how much she championed, like, women getting the right to vote. Now, I knew that them girls, I knew them Hafiz was racist.
Yeah.
Okay, like Susan B. Anthony and all them girls. I knew they were racist. I knew that, like, to some degree that, like, that black women and white women worked together in the suffrage movement, which is also why I couldn't really get into that. I think there was, like, an HBO or some movie that came out.
Nah, it wasn't an HBO movie. It was a wide release. The Suffragist?
Yeah, I wouldn't see it because I had no desire.
Even the promotion, you see the shit with, like, Meryl Streep and, like, a whole bunch of the other
actresses. White women, yeah.
Yeah, and they were like, I am a slave.
Yeah, or something like that. I was like, just like...
they were in the t-shirts? Yeah, I was like...
Yeah, I was like, this is not for me. But yeah, I had no idea that Ida B. Wells was so entrenched in that effort. And it became apparent to me once I learned more about that, that, like, obviously she, like, racism erased her from... like the history of those conversations. So that was something I realized as I was learning more about her. But when I really, as I've been getting into the Giddings book, it's been blowing my mind how additionally, like I figured that Ida B. Wells' contributions were downplayed just because of general sexism against Black women by Black men today. But what I did not realize was how, like, it wasn't just a case of, like, Black, other, like, her contemporaries were not standing up for her back in the day, but, like, people just actively erased her contributions from the record books back then. Like, Carter G. Woodson, when he was starting Negro History Week, she went with her children to the presentation that he did during Negro History Week, and he was talking about, like, anti-lynching movements and, you know, who was involved. And she was upset because he didn't mention her.
Yeah.
Like, they were contemporaries. Like, they knew each other. They had worked together. Like, they knew each other. Like, they were, I guess to put it colloquially, they were cool. And then he, you know what I mean? And then he did this presentation. It was like, these were all the important people that she was not mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, even in terms of, so she participated in the, I think it's the Niagara movement, which led like directly not to the creation of the NAACP.
Yeah.
And she was there and played an integral role in that. And they left her, you know, out of the original list of founders. Like, she's widely credited with that now, but that wasn't how it was when the shit first came out. And she was like, yo, what's the deal? And he was like, oh, I thought you'd see what happened was I thought you didn't actually want to be involved, which she later didn't.
Yeah, later she was like, y'all talk no action. I'm quitting this shit. I gotta go.
You know, which people still make that same critique today. But, but still, that erasure, like you said, like it has always kind of clearly been prevalent throughout her work and her life, and even now.
One of the pieces that we read that was like is a good overview, I would say, that would lead one to be curious about more of her stuff was like a Jezebel just write up about her life, and they called her the mother of intersectionality, and it makes me so. We've had, there have been conversations, and we don't necessarily need to rehash because we talked about it on the show before, about Black women's erasure from even, like, the movements that are happening presently, and conversations that still need to be had about Black women's inclusion and safety in these movements now. And it's just wild. You can see small ways in which erasure happens today, but, like, it's nothing new whatsoever because the same shit was happening to her back then. Even if you think about like feminists now, like, you know, there's a lot of important Black feminist work, but that like doesn't always get credited as being feminist work or isn't seen as essential feminist thought that everybody needs to read or everybody needs to know about or isn't included in the canon. And it's like this shit has been happening to Black women for forever. And they refer to her as the mother of intersectionality. Like, she's one of the first, the largest political figures I could think of in the post-Reconstruction era, who's, no matter how influential she was, because of her specific identity as a Black woman, it was like her contributions, they fell upon deaf ears, but her contributions were just like, it was like they could just be wiped away by white women or wiped away by Black men.
I mean, even specifically to dig down on that, there was a kind of a huge thing, and this was actually probably referenced a couple times throughout the reading that we'll supply.
Uh-huh.
So, like, and this kind of doubles down on how, like, she approached intersectionality. So, basically, in the initial, like, suffragist or temperance, is that how you pronounce it?
Well, temperance, I think, also was some other stuff, too. But,
But in the initial, like, suffragist movement, initially, like, Black women played a larger part in this. Then Black men got the right to vote.
And white women were like, peace.
Yeah. And so basically, like, a lot of really prominent white suffragists basically came out and were like, you'll give the Black man the right to vote, and basically called into question, like, Black people's moral character.
They sit at the bar. Because the temperance, part of the temperance movement is, like, also, like, social conservatism and, like, you know, not having, you know, bars and all this kind of shit. She's like, Black folks, all they want to know is where the liquor at.
Yeah.
It sounds real familiar, actually. All they do is hang out in bars and not do shit and blah, blah, blah,
and
blah.
And reproduce at, like, ridiculous wild rates.
Yeah. So this woman, Frances Willard, she was, like, the head of the Christian American Women's Temperance Movement or whatever. She and Ida was cool. And I want to say she had been, like, an abolitionist or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, she generally, like, you know, Black folks was like, all right, she's all
right. She's okay. She's straight. Right. So then she did this interview after Black men got the right to vote. And she was like, can you believe these drunken, fucking lascivious brutes? Can you believe this shit? And Ida was like,
nah, son.
Okay, I see you. And she also went over to Britain, which, again, the fact that anti-lynching and also suffragist work brought a black woman born into slavery out of the United States into Britain for an extended amount of time in the late 18, early 1900s. Like, is wild as hell.
Yeah.
So she was over there.
And she went over there just to basically appeal, like, yo, America ain't got this shit together.
Yeah, like, can y'all believe this? And they were like, we hear what you're saying, but we can't believe that Frances Willard would say this. Like, they're like, this seems a little wild. So then, so she and Frances Willard were speaking at this event together. And this is a, like, I read this and I was like, this woman is the shit.
Yeah.
Whoever was running the conversation was like, so, Ida B. Wells, what do you think about Frances Willard? So she, in response, this is the coldest shit ever done. In response, she just pulled out the interview.
In my mind, I see her, like, doing her old school granny style, like, reaching in her bra and pulling out, like, some folded paper and then fold there real quick. Like, let me tell you about this.
Yeah.
I almost called her
out. Exactly.
But, yeah.
So she,
this girl here.
Yep. She reads the, she just reads the interview. So she read that out loud because she's trying to get people to be like, look, like she really said this. Y'all need to reprint this over here so people can find out about what this woman and what she really about. So yeah, y'all can know that she's really not about shit. I wish I could do some shit like that.
See, I got some receipts.
Right. Like that, like Ida B. Wells had receipts.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, she was so real. And so then after that happened,
They tried to come for her real talk.
They tried to come for her real talk. Yeah. And so she came to Frederick Douglass.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't really like, he didn't support, or as we like to say, he also didn't have her back.
He didn't have her back. That's
right. And so, like, that, to me, that really hurt my feelings because yeah, I'm like, okay, I know way more about Frederick Douglass's life than I do about Ida B. Wells. Frederick Douglass is somebody we talk about in school. Like, it makes me sad that, like, she kind of needed his support, and he was like, I kind of still need these relationships with these white women.
And he's cultivated. He had cultivated a lot. Well, just with white people in general.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. He was kind of like, I still got my white audience. I can't really cave for you on this. That's fucked up. But, like, as it stands today, like, I'd say most people have a much stronger understanding of, like, Frederick Douglass's contributions to society than they do Ida B. Wells. And it's like, that's fucking sad. But, like, that's the way the cookie was crumbling back then.
I mean, I think in general, that whole situation is like, I mean, it goes back to a lot of the, like, it, you know, when we're talking about intersectionality, like, it goes back to a lot of the issues, like you said, that are still going on today. You know, like, they couldn't, like, it was impossible for white women to acknowledge the fact that, like they had to immediately separate themselves as, quote unquote, they use the term just women, but as white women from women of color, or, you know, I was going to say people of color, but black women, you know, at the time.
They started courting Southern, because all of these girls was up in New York.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They started courting Southern white women once they realized they were like, oh, we can't hang with these Negro women. We got to cut them out. Yeah. And then go, like, talk to these Southern white women about what brutes they all are.
Yeah. And I mean, and those are divides that really, I mean, if you look at it, they persisted for
today.
To today.
Right. Like, I mean, I have not a ton of trust in white feminists, which I think is justified.
Yeah.
And like that's a conversation that, like, bell hooks was having, you know what I'm saying, 20 years ago. And, like, 20 years before that, there were black feminists in the 60s and 70s who were having these same conversations of just mistrust of white women. And they were always like, you know, come join the movement, come join the movement, come join the movement. And it's like,
yeah,
join, like, what do you mean join? Like, what do you mean join? Like come join the fight for women's rights. Like, I am a woman, so I don't have I still don't have a lot of trust for that. And I knew the roots for that from, like, the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, but I really didn't understand, and even the 90s if you think about it, but I really didn't understand, like, how deep the shit really was, and how, like, I mean, I wasn't surprised, but how seriously Ida was getting it from all angles and just abandoned by the people who she was always fighting for, but she never stopped.
Yeah. So what this reminds me of a lot is kind of the situation that happened with basically in the publishing industry recently. Uh-huh. So there was an article that came out by this white writer. Her name was, like, Claire.
Claire Watkins.
Claire Watkins.
Claire V. Watkins.
The type of the essay was on pandering. And so in it, she was talking about she really struggles because she finds herself writing basically for the male gaze a lot. you know, mm-hmm. like, because she knows that white men carry a lot of power in the publishing industry, and she finds herself writing, you know, to kind of, with the idea that they're going to read it, and pandering to what would make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was a problem with that, and also just a problem because white men run the publishing industry. Plot twist. So after that, Marlon James, who's another really, really, really great writer, black man, he came out and was like, you know, if you really look at that, like a lot of people of color, a lot of that is kind of pandering, if you will, or has to be, like, we have to kind of pander and like kowtow, if you will, to the whims of white women, because that's who actually like drives the sales in the publishing industry. So a lot of that is affected by that white female gaze. And that caused some issues. Like, so yeah.
This is deep.
So, you know, and basically after that, a lot of white women were like, well, no, we don't have, you know, power. We aren't in the room as much as we should be. You know, like, this is something, like, basically, we aren't the problem here.
You can't see my face, but I'm like, okay, sure,
and
sure.
What it seemed like there was an inability to understand is that, like, to a certain point, yes, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the absolute power within the publishing industry, it probably is very tightly controlled by white men. But second to that, it is white women.
And always.
Yes. And they are the overwhelming, like largest group and largest demographic of people who are actually purchasing, mm-hmm. like, large-scale books. So if you look at how people are making decisions and the books that are actually getting published, it's things that are going to, like,
please white women.
To please white women. And again, that just, it kind of really shined, like, a huge light on the divide there. And it was, I mean, honestly, real talk, it was some, like, it made for, like, quite a few, like, really great days on Twitter.
I can't believe I missed this.
Yeah, like, Roxanne Gay went in, like, a couple times. Like, I mean, she didn't, like, have, like, you know, this massive list of twists, but it wasn't
a Kanye.
Yeah, no. But it was a lot of, like, emoji eyes, like,
like, little Kermit sipping tea.
Yeah, and honestly, it was really interesting, like, and there was actually some research right after that showed that, like, in terms of the workers in the publishing industry, it's actually, like, I want to say it's like 60% white women.
Yeah.
But it just shows, like, that like separation, like that constant separation, because there's no, like, consideration of, like, the kind of that hierarchy of privilege.
Yeah.
And how that works within these various different industries.
It's weird. It's like a lot of white women don't think that they're second in line, but they're always second in line.
Yeah.
They're always second in line and they don't see it. And it just blows my mind. I mean, it blows my mind, like, now in general, but then to go back and to see that Ida was dealing with the same shit, where they're like, they're pissed. They're like, well, black men got the right to vote. And it's like, first of all, girl, barely. Second of all, like,
we can't exercise that right to vote because we're getting lynched.
We can still barely exercise that right to vote, and it's like 110 years later. But then, like, also, like, white women's political identity and, like, the formation of that. Because, like, now that we're talking about it more, and now that I'm, like, reading about it more, I've never made it a huge point to read about white women's political identity. But same. White women's political identity is the default from which mine is cast. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so, like, now I'm sort of thinking about it and I'm like, well, maybe I should read more into this. But it seemed like,
say more about the, like, say, explain that concept. So you said something that was really interesting. So you say white women's political identity is the default
from which, like, my political identity is a lot of times only given context by, like, because of white women's political identity. There's the obvious thing where it's like, okay, like, I never, like, we women like me don't really ever get a seat at the table as far as feminism. Feminism is concerned, but, like, ideologically, as far as feminism is concerned. But, like, when people talk about pay disparity, like wage and income disparities, they only talk about white women. When people say women, they only mean white women still. And, like, I guess I'm seen as, like, an outlier in a way. I'm very interested in the formation of women as, like, or white women as, like, a voting bloc, as, like, a political group, as, like, a group with their own, like, interests, and how those interests are served or not served. you know, in all of these different ways, whether it be through activism or through voting or through holding political office. Again, a side note, holding political office is something that Ida B. Wells, again, like, strove to do in yeah. her, like, lifetime.
Something else that you said that really stuck out to me in uh-huh. terms of that, like, the political identity stuff, I think is really interesting to me as a black man, because I honestly don't know what, like, the black man's political identity, like, in terms of, like, an offshoot of that. I feel like a lot of times we have to kind of, like, we, a lot of our, like, obviously ours is tied, like, in terms of
yeah,
black men.
I feel like you guys
woman.
Are, I feel like when people think of, I feel like when people think of women, they think of white women. I mean, yeah. This has been said before by many other people. People think of black people, they think of black men.
Correct. But in terms of how we wield our political power, it's kind of interesting in that. Like, we obviously are much more, we have much more representation in terms of legislator, mm-hmm. but in terms of how
representation
in terms of like actual public office.
No, but in terms of like more representation than who?
Oh, sorry, than black women.
Yeah.
Than black women specifically. But in terms of the actual work that's being done to a lot of times advance our causes is primarily done by black women. Which I think is kind of an interesting disconnect, but also is reflected in Ida B. Wells's legacy.
Yeah. I mean, lynching is something that disproportionately affected black men.
Yeah.
And she was on the front lines for that.
Yeah. And in terms of bringing light to that and actually advancing that, and then her not necessarily being recognized for those efforts,
yeah.
I feel like that's something that, I mean, as you mentioned, happens relatively frequently.
Yeah, we know this.
But I still come back and I wonder, like, and so if you look at I think we talked about like the hierarchy, almost like a hierarchy of needs in terms of how people who aren't white men get political power.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at like the right to vote, obviously it was black men and then white women.
Yeah.
And then if you look at even like the presidency.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. Assuming the presidency. Yeah.
Assuming the presidency, it looks like all things being equal, it seems like it's going to happen the exact same way.
Yeah.
But if you look at also like equal pay. I mean, that's something that definitely affects women, but it also affects minorities as well. Like, so incorporating men into that context as well.
Uh-huh.
Like, how we will actually approach gaining equality in pay and in work. So what I'm trying to say is, like, I'm curious as to, with the work that's being done,
uh-huh.
how will the actual rules change in favor of whom and first, and who gets it first.
Oh, yeah, and who gets it first.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, especially within the equal pay movement, like you said, I think there is a lot of attention being paid to white women. But
yeah.
a lot of the actual effects, you know, if there were equal pay legislation, would probably affect women of color more, even though they aren't necessarily the...
We're not the people in mind. Why do you think they would affect us more?
Just because a lot of times we are, in term, if you think about the size of women who are in the workplace at certain levels.
Mm.
So this one plays, this kind of ladders up with the, like with my work, with my job.
Yeah.
And I've read research that talks about this, but there's an overwhelming amount of black women who make either at or under minimum wage
uh-huh.
and who are also like single in the workforce. So they're very much affected by, like, if we raise a minimum wage, that would change the life of a lot of women of color.
Yeah.
But also if there were equal pay, that would also change the dynamics of how women make money in the country as well.
Yeah.
So if you look at, like, if we think, we talk about equal pay, more often than not, we're thinking about almost like executive pay.
Yeah, a lot of people are.
Yeah, a lot of people think about executive pay like, oh, I am a manager. I should be paid as much as this other manager who is a man, who's probably a white man.
Yeah.
But realistically, it's the effects lower down on the pipeline that yeah. have the most amount of people.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say the effects would actually be felt probably a lot more
yeah.
for people of color and women of color, like, down the line, as opposed to...
like these professional white women.
Exactly. But just because of the size of the different groups.
Interesting.
But that said, it's still white women who are mostly kind of in front
yeah.
of this charge and how they actually lead it.
Yeah, like Sheryl Sandberg comes to mind. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, lean in. Like, if you think about that, that's all about how women amass more power and ultimately, like, get in,
yeah.
like, get in, get equal, like,
Compensation? Not
necessarily the compensation, but equal respect even in the workplace.
Yeah, and I guess the unspoken part of that is leading to compensation and representation in higher levels of management.
Exactly. But, you know, lean in doesn't work for everybody.
No.
And, you know, there's been a lot of sustained criticism that, you know, I'm somewhat hypocritical that this woman who, you know, has access to a ridiculous amount of resources has almost like a daycare center in her office, or has a nanny in her office that she can go to work and bring this person. Of course, it's her ability to be able to lean into her workplace and like just work harder and focus more on like what you're doing basically in the workplace, as opposed to someone who doesn't have access to the resources to be able to like commit basically to their gig, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense.
So, I mean, anyway, we took a bit of a journey and walking around, but basically what I'm trying to say is it's really interesting to see how, you know, a lot of time, like there's always been this kind of game we've played where white women a lot of times think there is inclusion.
Yeah.
And the immediate distribution of resources doesn't look like it's going to be what they would prefer.
Yeah.
Those, like...
strong left. There's a strong left.
Those allegiances then strongly diverge and then separate, and often leaving out black women in the mix.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think to bring it back, to bring it full circle, if we, you know, do look at the contributions of someone like Ida B. Wells.
Yeah.
You know, and we recognize that we need to not erase but elevate the women who are doing, you know, the work in terms of advancing our people to the place in which, you know, we should be.
Yeah.
Things will get a little better.
Yeah. Well, you know what I say? Ida B. Wells, I think I pointed out to you this morning that there's no black women has a national holiday.
Yeah.
I don't even think any white women have national holidays here either. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about black women. And I think that Ida B. Wells is more deserving of a national holiday than anybody that is I think she's as deserving of it as you can possibly be.
Yeah, even if you look at like there's a lot of conversation around putting a woman on the $20 bill.
Mm-hmm.
Like she would be an amazing contribution. And some people have suggested it.
I would love it if every single time people talk about like, oh, blah, 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 like, you know, because, you know, there's lots of reasons. There's lots of reasons why people have problems with currency in the United States by black people or people of color or, you know, whatever. Woke folks have problems. But I'm going to tell you something right now. At the end of the day, $20 bill is what comes out of the ATM.
Yeah.
And if every time a motherfucker had to look at a $20 bill and saw Ida B. Wells' face, as opposed to one of these fucking slave owners over here, put Ida on the currency. I'm cool with it.
Yeah.
I'm ready for it.
Need to change it up.
So national holiday, put her on the court. At least have a unit on her in school or something like that. Yeah. Teach, like, I went to Howard and we didn't really talk about her that much, truth be told.
Yeah, I mean, same. I honestly, until I started reading more about her biography recently, and at your prodding, to be straight up, like, I honestly didn't know much about her at all. And I honestly, it was frankly, I was looking at myself like, damn, what the fuck? Like, I'm a very proud Memphian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, she played an extremely significant role to the history of Memphis. I'm like, fuck, man.
Yeah.
It's some conversations need to be had.
There's some conversations need to be had. So I am in favor of like whatever we gotta do to get this woman to be the center of some type of conversation, like whether it be like, you know, whether I gotta become the Stevie Wonder of the group, and you know, start lobbying for a national holiday, whatever. I don't care. I just think this woman is she's a true American hero.
Yes.
And shit, all the shit that respectable people care about: having education, being married, having kids. Covering truth and justice, taking care of family, bootstrapping. She did all that shit.
Yeah.
And she also didn't give a fuck about any of y'all's respectability bullshit. So I think, you know,
we
let her have a day.
That. Yeah. One day.
Shit, yeah.
We need more holidays in general.
We need more holidays in general. Everybody, shit, I could use a day off.
Yeah, right.
I love my job and I'm still like, I just, tomorrow, coming to work tomorrow, I'm still like,
I could take a day.
I could take another day. So, you know what? Or maybe actually, when you know, I'm crazy. So I'm like, it would be really fun to have a holiday where only black people took off. I'd be Wells Day. All white people got to work. And their pay gets withheld.
That would be.
And I get holiday pay and I don't have to go.
Shit. That's some reparations.
That's some reparations.
So it's a lot that could be said about that.
It's a lot could be said about this. So yeah. So
anyway, thank you.
Thank you for listening and like read up on. I'd say read any of her books. Like I said, it's not like we're not complaining when we say that we have to seek information about this woman out. It's a joy to, but we shouldn't have to, and you shouldn't have to. So read up on her.
I mean, read a few of the articles if you can. Read her biography and share it with somebody.
Yeah, share it with somebody. Get to talking about it and like, yeah. Thank you, Ida B. Wells, for everything that you've done. Thank you for being a window for us into the Reconstruction period.
Yes.
And, you know, happy Black History Month, everybody. You know, give a round of applause to an American hero such as
Ida B. Wells.
Ida B. Wells.
All right. Bye.
Bye.